Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach, sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach, compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? Hi, I'm Carol the Coach. And the first question I would ask you, if you're listening to the show and you have lots of questions about whether you may have an issue or a problem with sexual addiction, I would ask, do you want to change that about yourself, regardless of the label you put on it, regardless of the behaviors, do you want to change? You know, sexual addiction takes on a variety of different behaviors. It is an obsessive, compulsive condition where you are unable to stop the behavior, or if you stop it, when it resumes, it starts back with a vengeance, more often than not, worse than when you stopped it. And so that gives you just enough time to kind of fool yourself. You think that you've got it under control, and then you quickly find out that you don't have it under control. You know, it reminds me of a man. This is actually a friend of mine. I knew him through another friend, and we really had a good time. Had a great time, as a matter of fact, playing pool and exercising together. And he said, I'm a self-proclaimed alcoholic, but I'm in recovery. I go to AA, and I am not going to drink for 20 years. But on my 20th anniversary, I'm going to get drunk as a skunk. And we all laughed and thought that was silly, because anybody who was as abstinent as this man was, who worked as hard on a program, we just thought there was no way he would go back to drinking. Certainly not on the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of his sobriety. But there is something obsessive and compulsive about the brain. And had I known more about addiction back then, and I didn't, I would have said to myself, that is a self-proclaimed reality that he is going to live out, because on his 20th year, the day of his anniversary, he went back to drinking and he didn't make the next year. It was like he knew he could control himself, but he had that fallacy that once he resumed drinking, he would be able to control that too. And that's not what addiction is all about. Addiction is not controllable. Oh, yeah, sure. There may be binge sex addicts people that go out and have long periods of what we call sexual anorexia, and they're fooling themselves because they go, see, I can control it. But they always go back to previous behaviors that are self-destructive, obsessive, and compulsive in nature. Now, I got a really interesting email from somebody who listens to the show, and I'm going to give him a different name. He says, hi, Carol. My name is Mike. I'm a 40-year-old male. I listen to a few of your shows, and they are very informative. I'm a sex addict, and I know it. And, you know, for any of you listening to the show, you can always email me if you feel uncomfortable calling the show at 646-595-3284. Feel free to email me, and I'll read your email on the air. He says, the thing is, I have never been able to allow myself to get too close to anyone before. I've been in relationships, and they all have failed. I was even engaged 3 summers ago, only to have my fiancé call off the wedding before it was to take place. Needless to say, I'm still in a lot of pain over that because I love this person, and I thought our love was real. And then he says, ma'am, I wish you wouldn't call me ma'am. I listened to your show, and you mentioned trauma in a person's life and how that can lead to addiction. And he's absolutely right. You know, we talk about two types of sexual or love addiction, depending on what the issue is. Tonight we're going to be talking to Marnie Free, who is the director of Bethesda. And she does BethesdaWorkshops.org, and she has written a book called No Stones, Women Redeemed from Sexual Shame. And she's going to talk about, can women really have sexual addictions, and what is the difference between love and sex addiction? Well, anyway, he said, Mike said, you know, can trauma cause sexual addiction? I've heard you say that it can. And as I was indicating, yes, there are two types of sexual addiction. One that is created from trauma and usually leads to something we call trauma reenactment, where there is some level of sexual addiction that actually reenacts the trauma that occurred as a young child. So if you are a sexually addicted male or female, and you have to have a lot of partners, and you have to have anonymous sex, perhaps you were sexually molested by a lot of people in your childhood, and your desire to have anonymous sex is so that you won't feel hurt by your potential sexual partner. As you know, if you don't know them and if you don't get close to them, they can't really hurt you and you maintain control. Well, Mike says he was severely disfigured at age 18, and he found it very difficult to meet women and to have meaningful relationships. He says this world can be very mean and superficial. I work a full-time job as a FedEx driver, and I consider myself a good person. I attend church every week and also drive the church van for the people who don't have cars. He asks, do you think I'm doomed to be all alone for the rest of my life due to my disfigurement and due to the fact that I have this problem of sexual addiction? But he didn't describe why he thinks he's a sex addict. So that would be my first question, Mike. I would want to know, what makes you believe you're a sex addict? Is it that you're just afraid of getting close and developing true intimacy because you don't feel good about yourself? Because the last two questions you ask are, do you have any suggestions on how to gain confidence and not be so self-conscious, even when people are mean? And yeah, I really do. You know, one of the things you said is you're involved in church. And let's face it, although parishioners of any church may be mean-spirited, they may bully you, the majority of Christians that I know and that I have presented to in workshops and conferences are good, kind-hearted people that practice they practice loving the person unconditionally. I mean, that is what Jesus did. And so I don't find them in general to be mean-spirited. And I'm so thankful that not only are you involved in a church, but that you actually drive the church van. I mean, you're giving back. And that is so important with sexual addiction. So important. So I would ask you to be around other supportive people. Now, what I mean by other supportive people, I mean, if you truly believe you have a sexual addiction, and you can always go to www.sexhelp.com and take the test and know for sure whether you absolutely do or not, get yourself into SA or SAA and become part of a 12-step community that supports you no matter who you are, no matter how much money you have, no matter where you live, and no matter what you look like. Because truly, these people can not only make you feel socially supportive, but certainly the 12-step program is based on looking at your character defects and creating stronger character. You know, that's one of the reasons that I almost always invariably give my clients the exercise to come up with 50 personality strengths that they like about themselves. You know, that wouldn't look like I'm handsome, I'm a good dad, I'm a good mom, I'm beautiful. It would be, what do you like about your personhood? You know, what do you like about your personality? And then what I want you to do is come up with some adjectives that describe that. Perhaps you're generous or kind or smart or grateful, loving, compassionate, thoughtful, insightful, generous. So those are some of the words that describe who you are and help to build that sense of confidence. And when you know your personality strengths and you're around supportive people and you're consistently working on yourself, that's going to build your confidence, Mike. And when you have more confidence and feel better about yourself, you'll be a better partner and you'll make a better relationship. And it sounds like you're very lonely and you want a relationship. And I can't blame you. I mean, if you've dealt with disfigurement on any level, you're right. When you feel like you look different, you know, that's a big obstacle to overcome. But I'm telling you, you get yourself around the right groups, the right people that emphasize the right qualities, and you will feel so much better about who you are. So send me an email. Feel free to do that at carolthecoach@AOL.com and let me know why you think you're a sex addict. And we can talk more about that either on the show or I'll be happy to address that. Okay, coming up, we have Marnie Free, who is the director of Bethesda Workshops out of Nashville, Tennessee. And she is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She's written a fabulous book, I read it, called No Stones, Women Redeemed from Sexual Addiction. And tonight she's going to be talking about female sex and love addicts. You know, is there really such a thing? If so, what is the difference? And she happens to know because she has had the disorder herself. She's in recovery, and she has made it her mission to help other people, to educate them, and to support them in their recovery. So I know that you'll absolutely find her fascinating, and her book is amazing. So welcome to the show, Marnie. How are you?
Thanks, Carol. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I know you've made it your mission for a long, long time to educate people about sexual recovery, sexual addiction, and love addiction, and certainly with women as well as men, but with women, you know, they can go either way or they can dabble in both. So I was excited that you were going to be coming on the show and talking a little bit about this subject. You know, you brought up some celebrities, Russell Brand, David Duchovny, Jesse James, even President Clinton and Tiger Woods, that have all been labeled with sexual addiction. And I was wondering, since you're a grateful, recovering sex and love addict, do you really feel this issue affects women?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we vastly underestimate, as a culture, women's struggle with sexuality, with addictive sexual and relationship behavior, and this issue does affect women. I think that the pattern is following more what we saw in our understanding of alcoholism, meaning in the beginning we thought surely women didn't have this problem, surely women didn't drink in an out-of-control way, that it was only men. And today, of course, we know that, generally speaking, about half of those who struggle with alcoholism are female. And I really believe that ultimately we will find that to be true when it comes to sex and love addiction as well.
Well, and you know, this is such a tough topic. It's one of the reasons that I have this radio show, is because so many people joke about these behaviors and they don't realize that it's a real disorder. They don't realize how obsessive and compulsive it is, and they make jokes about it. Same things like, well, wouldn't that be fun for guys if they were with a lover of
right.
sex addicts? Or, oh, sex addicts, men, they're just boys being boys. So can you tell me, how did you get interested in this area?
Well, as you mentioned in your kind introduction, I got interested in this area from my own personal struggles with sex and love and relationship addiction. It had been something I'd struggled with since my late teens. I had no framework for that, no understanding for that. I knew that I was very promiscuous. I grew up in a strong Christian home. I'm a preacher's kid. And so I knew that the kind of behavior I was engaging in was outside my value system. And yet, even from probably college age, I found that I couldn't stop. I had experienced a lot of consequences because of my behavior, and my form of acting out was primarily promiscuity before I married, and then multiple affairs after I married. And despite consequences, I lost my first marriage because of my acting out. My first husband and I divorced. I remarried pretty quickly, had two children pretty quickly, and after just a few years began a pattern of acting out again. And again found that I couldn't stop. I was leading a double life. I was singing in the church choir and writing nice, good, spiritual, inspirational things and having affairs all over the place, and overwhelmed with shame. And finally, consequences caught up with me. I was diagnosed in the early 1990s with cervical cancer caused by HPV. Mm-hmm. And so that really got my attention and went through a health crisis about that ultimately brought me to a place of realizing I am powerless over this and my life is absolutely out of control. So it was my own journey, Carol, that got me interested in this. I've been on a healing journey since 1992, and I'm very grateful for the way that my life has changed and the help that I've gotten. So as you mentioned, it is a passion of my life now in a whole different way to try to help others, particularly women who are struggling with sex and love addiction, to know that this is a very real problem. It's not fun. It certainly was not fun for either one of my husbands, but there is a way out.
And I'm assuming that you've made amends to both, and that was part of the healing process.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's an ultimate part of the journey, but there's lots of hard work that's got to happen before that.
Well, 100%. You know, you said it was a cervical cancer. At that point, it really brought to home that you weren't invincible, that you couldn't continue these behaviors. You hit rock bottom, and you needed to turn your life around. And today, my clients struggle with where they can get help because oftentimes in sex addict meetings, men don't feel comfortable with women in their meetings, and women don't feel strong enough to create all-women meetings. So what was it like for you back in 1992?
Well, I definitely faced that same challenge as well. I did my early recovery work with a therapist who is, interestingly enough, was one of maybe a couple of dozen people in the country in the early 1990s who had trained with Dr. Patrick Carnes. And so she was able immediately to recognize what I was dealing with, to give it a name, to explain it. I hated the name, of course. I was kind of like, a sex addict? I can't possibly be a sex addict. I mean, I've had some affairs, but a sex addict? That's so awful. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, had to finally accept responsibility for that and realize that, that label, as distasteful as it might be, did fit. I'm also a sexual trauma survivor, and so we did a lot of work about those issues of sexual abuse and different kinds of family dysfunction first. But there came a point where she kept insisting I really needed to go to meetings and I needed to go to 12-step meetings, and I equally strongly insisted I was not going to do that. You know, I talked to her, but I wasn't going to go put myself out there with anybody else in terms of being known with this secret. And finally, again, had another kind of rock-bottom experience and realized I couldn't do this by myself, not even with the help of a good therapist. And that day went to my first 12-step meeting. And when I walked into that S fellowship, it was me and 20 men. And I knew before I left that meeting, you know, generally meetings are about an hour, and I cried through the whole thing, and I didn't say a word. I didn't even tell them my name. I knew when I left that I am home. These people understand me. They are telling my story. They, many of them seem to have something in terms of recovery and progress and healing that I wanted, but I also knew that it wasn't a safe place for me. And it wasn't because the meeting wasn't safe, it was because I wasn't safe. I knew I couldn't stay present in that environment and get the help that I needed. And I think that's still a real challenge for women today, that women still are very much in the minority in terms of S meetings in most parts of the country. So my therapist helped me figure out some alternative ways, and I did my early 12-step work in a women's-only AA meeting. And that was very helpful, just to be in the language of the 12 steps in recovery. But it's, that part is still a real challenge.
Well, I didn't know, because obviously you've worked really hard at providing treatment to women, and that sounds like a very good start, because there are plenty of really good women's AA meetings. So that's a good place for women to consider going if they're listening to the show and they need to find out more about what the 12 steps can give them. Because I don't know if you heard my entire intro, but certainly I was I had an email from a man named Mike that doesn't feel like he has the confidence to be even a part of anything like that. And and you know, I said, and for women, that men, you know, men really do get it. They get what they're going through because they have the same issues. But at the same time, sometimes having a woman in a meeting can be a trigger. And that's why I think unless you've got a lot of good recovery, women's meetings are probably the best choice no matter what.
They often are, especially early in the process. I do think it's important to caution women. If you go to an open kind of AA meeting where it's a mixed meeting and males and females both present, it really is important not to identify yourself as a sex or love addict. Because, sadly, one of the things we're aware of today is that many individuals who struggle with chemical addiction, with alcohol, for example, are also struggling with sex addiction. And so for a woman to sashay into a meeting and identify herself as a sex addict, it's kind of like, fresh bait, you know. And not a healthy place. So, you know, to honor the tradition of the anonymity of the meetings, if you're not struggling with the issue, you need to go to open meetings, which means that anyone is welcome to attend. And if a woman chooses to share in that environment, to just say, well, my drug of choice, because, you know, people typically will think that's alcohol, or maybe they'll think that's drugs, and she will know that that choice is men or some kind of sexual activity, but it's providing her some safety in that environment. And that's important if she's not involved in a women's only, doesn't have opportunity to be in a women's only meeting.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, let's just define for the listening audience, what would you say the characteristics of a female sex addict is versus a female love addict?
That's a great question, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about that, and in fact, I think there's a lot of unnecessary controversy. One of the things that a premise that we took in a book that I had the privilege of editing recently called Making Advances, A Comprehensive Guide for Treating Female Sex and Love Addicts. It's a kind of textbook for clinicians on working with this population. And it's also something that I've put forth in No Stones, my book for women themselves who struggle. I really think that obviously some of the behaviors are different, that women who are sex addicts are often engaging in what we might stereotypically think of as male addict behaviors. They are doing internet-based behaviors. They are looking at pornography. More and more women are addicted to the plain old visual pornography that's out there. They're involved in sexual chat rooms and maybe even in Second Life or other kinds of virtual reality. They may be having anonymous sex, so women don't call it that as much, but you know, they're meeting somebody in a bar and picking up that person or letting themselves be picked up and then being sexual with that person, which is truly defined as anonymous sex, sex with someone you've just met. So those are the more sexual kind of activities. The women who identify as love addicts or relationship addicts tend, generally speaking, to be what it sounds like, more involved in relationships and patterns of whether it's affairs if they're married or promiscuity, serial relationships going from one to another to another to another. If they're not married, from something, again, it might be technology-based, but it's more about the relationship than it is about sex. And so historically we thought these are two really different types of behaviors and different presentations of addiction. I would suggest that actually they really are the same type of thing. In terms of think about, again, what we know from alcoholism. We just call all individuals who are struggling with some kind of alcoholic content alcoholics. And it doesn't really matter whether it's beer or hard liquor or champagne.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same. And I really believe that's the most logical and helpful way to think about sex and love addiction, that while some of the behaviors may be different, these underlying characteristics of what are driving the behaviors and some of the standard characteristics of what makes addictive behavior addictive are the same. And so we fuss about the label and we, you know, have our theoretical discussions about the label. And I think those aren't particularly helpful, that labeling people doesn't necessarily helping them understand what really it is that they're dealing with, and giving them kind of a structure, a construct of understanding their behavior is what's most helpful. I think, Carol, anyone who's struggling with any form of sex addiction will tell you that it's not about the sex. This is not about the sexual release at all, even though maybe that's what somebody is experiencing maybe multiple times a day. What this is about overarching is that desperate need for some kind of connection, some kind of affirmation and approval and attention and connection. And it's that dynamic that is the common denominator between the different forms of acting out.
Well, that makes total sense, as well as that sense of control that occurs in both sex addiction and love addiction, even though it appears like there's a sense of control when really it's out of control behavior that they can't control. But
That's exactly right.
Yeah, at least they get to orchestrate or hope to what they want in their lives. And so what I heard you saying is that part isn't that important. What's the difference? So you had said the idea of love addiction sounds more plausible. And that women that are love addicted probably are more addicted to the relationship itself than really to the sex. Don't you think that our culture encourages women to be more in touch with their sexuality these days than in the past?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, you only have to take a look at all the mainstream media, even forget any kind of so-called adult media, but just mainstream media is very much about freedom and women's sexuality and all of those kinds of things. I think the challenge then is for a woman to recognize that she's having a problem in the area of sex and relationships, because the norms are skewing some. There's not quite as much stigma associated with a woman who is acting out as there used to be, though I still think that there's a good bit of extra shame associated with women.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because sexuality is very important in terms of my teachings, and everybody
sure.
this entire year said, have you read 50 Shades of Grey?
Right.
And I said, no, I haven't. And they said, how could you not read that book? And I said, you know, just from the reviews, for me, that people were actually turned on by the lack of intimacy in that book and the control issues. And, yes, there was a whole relationship part of that, but I didn't feel it promoted healthy sex. And so I thought, why am I, you know, this is an intimacy disorder, sexual addiction and love addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Perhaps you read that book, but I sure didn't hear anything about a truly loving relationship where there's trust and it's based on love. What do you think, Marnie? I know I threw that at you. What's your
opinion? That's okay. That's okay. I think that you're hitting on a really important part about healthy sexuality, and I would say, obviously, that sexually addictive relationship, addictive behavior is not a part of sexuality, and that is that it's it is built on trust. It's built on vulnerability. It's built on honesty and real. And that's what women long for. That's what men long for. And the different forms of acting out are often forms of false intimacy. I absolutely agree with you that sex addiction is really best viewed as an intimacy disorder. This is, I don't know how really to have an intimate relationship. And I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about just letting myself be known and knowing another person. And so in our culture, we use sex as the best substitute for real intimacy. In fact, very often we equate the two terms, and they're not synonymous necessarily. And so I think that that coming to understand that is a very important part, especially in any kind of a committed relationship, is something that's really, really helpful. I actually have read 50 Shades of Grey and
mm-hmm.
all three of them, and I thought it was fascinating just in terms of our cultural enamorment with those trilogies and all of the highly sexual stuff in there. What I also saw, though, and maybe this is something we can talk about as the show progresses, is a abused individual in terms
mm-hmm.
of the male character, a
mm-hmm.
attachment deficit, meaning people who as young children did not get their healthy needs for relationship messed, and a lot of, when I read it with a clinical viewpoint, a whole lot of trauma reactions and trauma reenactments and trauma bonds and a whole lot of things that were a part of that relationship, and power and control definitely were a part of that, that actually as the trilogy went on, without any specific, you know, help that I was, it was real clear in the book in terms of how they did that, though one of the characters was involved in counseling, seemed to get some healing as these two people progressed and be able to have a closed monogamous relationship that seemed, in my opinion, to get healthier as it went on. But it's just really interesting to see how our culture has reacted to that kind of
portrayal of sexuality.
Yeah, my experience was what it drove clients and the women that I knew personally to want to explore sadomasochism and kind of that vulnerable, risky behavior. And then it seemed to denormalize regular sexuality, that is, you know, about open-eyed sex and sacred sex and that real loving connection. So that's why I say it. I probably need to read the book, too. I didn't want to endorse it. I was really opposed to that. So, okay.
I don't endorse it. I'm actually doing a writing project based on it. So I thought, I kind of like, I really have got to read this. But it actually was a very difficult read for me. As a recovering addict, it was very triggering. It was highly sexualized content that I learned eventually. Okay, I think I could just kind of turn all these pages and keep see what's going to happen next without reading through all of this. It was not a particularly enjoyable read for me, but anyway, it's been quite a cultural phenomenon.
Well, my women that were had love addictions and sex addictions in my practice really found it triggering, too. So I thought that was interesting, that it wasn't a safe book if you have any kind of obsessive or compulsive needs, and certainly with the addicts that I work with, they do. Now, I didn't meet many men that read it, so, you know, I do think in some ways men and women are so different, but yet they're also very, very alike. Tell me, how do you treat women? Because obviously, Bethesda workshops, lots of people want to know, is Bethesda the name of the program or the place?
Right.
So
right.
Tell me a little bit about the program.
Yeah, thank you. Bethesda is the name of the program and not a place. We are in Nashville, Tennessee, and people, you know, understandably, but make an assumption that we might be in Bethesda, Maryland, and we're not. The name actually comes from a Christian scripture, a story in the New Testament about a pool of Bethesda that was a literal pool in Jerusalem, and impaired people would lie there begging alms, lame and blind and so forth. And Jesus was walking by the pool and saw a man who had been lying there for 37 years. He was totally lame. He had been born that way. And the tradition was that an angel would come down from heaven and stir the waters in the pool, and whoever got in first would be healed. Well, hey, this guy's lame, so how is he supposed to, you know, get in the pool first? So he's just lying there in his group of wounded other impaired people in his victim state. And what Jesus asks him is an interesting question. He asks him, do you want to be well? And so we take that in our program, which is a clinical program, but we're coming from a broad Judeo-Christian worldview as well. We take that as a foundational question, because for anyone who's struggling with an addiction of whatever kind, the beginning point starts with willingness. You know, do you want to get well? And are you willing to make the normally very difficult changes in your life that you're going to have to make for that healing process? And so that's where the name comes from. We are in Nashville. We're also, though, a national program. People come from all across the country. People come, we've got a steady stream coming down from Canada, from Alaska. We have people come up from South America. We had a man come from Switzerland in the summer. So people come from everywhere to get help for sex and relationship addiction.
Okay, so it's for men and women both, and the programs are separate?
The programs are separate. Mm-hmm. The program began in 1997 when I realized that some of the treatment that was happening at that time for male sex addicts and then for their wives, I was involved in some of the early programs, intensive workshop type programs for those two populations, that this could so easily be adapted for women as who struggle themselves with sex and like addiction. And in fact, in 1997, began this workshop program. It's the first, as far as I know, as far as I can determine, the first gender-specific
program anywhere in the country targeting females who struggle with sex and relationship addiction. So that's always been a primary focus, but ultimately through the years, Bethesda workshops came also to treat in a separate intensive workshop men who struggle with sex and love addiction. We treat now partners of individuals who struggle with sex and relationship addiction, just meaning someone is in relationship with a person who struggles. Those are largely women, women whose guy is struggling. We do treat male partners. We have more and more men now who are coming who are involved with a female who struggles. And then our program is structured so that each person must come to an individual workshop first, but then if they're in a coupleship, they can come back as a couple. So we have what we call a healing for couples workshop after they come to their individual workshops. So it's a comprehensive program. We've got clinicians who come from across the country to facilitate the different workshops, and it's really amazing what happens in 4 days.
So that's how much time is involved in the initial phase, 4 days for these workshops.
Yes.
And do they stay on campus or do they stay in hotels?
They stay in a hotel. However, we have lots of structure about that. Everyone has to stay in the conference hotel, even if somebody lives, you know, two blocks from our center where we hold the workshops. They have to stay in the conference hotel. We call it the Bethesda bubble, meaning it's kind of a stop the world. I'm going to put aside all of my normal family or work or any kind of responsibilities. They turn in a cell phone or any other thing that will access, especially the internet, but any kind of communication, and just agree, I'm just going to focus on me for 4 days. We do 10 to 12 clinical hours a day, meaning from 8:15 in the morning till between 8 and 9 at night. People are there doing something specific about their healing process. And we eat all of our meals in the Bethesda Center and then shuttle people back to the conference hotel, and all the staff stays there with them so that the participants have access to help, you know, gender-specific help. Men come in and facilitate our men's workshop and women facilitate the women's workshops, but so that there's somebody available to them 24/7. So it's really the equivalent of months and months of weekly individual therapy.
It's a great kickstart, or a support if individual therapy isn't working and they need something more intensive.
Yes, and even it's a great adjunct to individual therapy because it gets you so far down the road, first just in terms of understanding all of this, of understanding what is an addiction or what does it mean that my partner struggles with an addiction, and, you know, how do I set boundaries, and just a whole lot of nuts and bolts of kind of recovery stuff. But it also provides people with a good bit of experiential activities. They do drawings and they do different kind of activities that just help bring all these kinds of concepts home and very applicable in a personal way to each participant. And then one of the greatest things, Carol, is that people get connected very deeply to the other people who are there. And that's a great thing because one of the realities of addiction, I think especially for women, is it's a very isolating problem. It's like, I don't want anybody to know about this. You know, this secret life is secret for a reason, because I'm embarrassed, because I'm ashamed, because I'm afraid of being judged. And so to be able to be very open about what the struggle has been and get not just accountability but get support for their process, so that, you know, obviously when somebody goes home, 4 days is no cure at all. This is a long-term process, but it gets them such a good start, and then it gives them a built-in support system of I've got my people. I've got people I can call when I get home and I'm trying to unpack all this and trying to walk it out and go to 12-step meetings and be involved with a counselor and with local support groups and all that kind of thing. I have people who understand, and I already feel safe with them because I know them. And that's
you've shared that intimacy.
Best benefit. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a really,
now,
really wonderful thing.
I'm assuming insurance does not pay for any of this.
That is correct. It is a total self-pay. However, within the treatment world, we are extremely
cost-effective and inexpensive. Our individual workshops are only $1,500, which includes our lodging and meals.
So, Marnie, that's a steal. That's not just inexpensive.
Yeah,
that is a steal.
Yeah. And the reason we can do that is that we are a nonprofit ministry. We are actually receive free housing in a church. And
oh my goodness.
So we get a separate wing that's dedicated to us that's off limits for anybody else, so there's lots of privacy and all of that. But we get free space, which is an enormous, enormous benefit. And so we pass that along to participants. And we can even also help anyone with a no-interest payment plan. Everyone must come up with half of that workshop fee before they arrive, but the second half, anyone, you don't have to qualify or anything. You just have to say, hey, I need a payment plan, and we'll self-fund that for you over either 2 months or 4 months to let you pay off the balance after your workshop. So there's really not much reason for somebody not to get the help that they need.
Well, how can they get a hold of you to find out more about this program or to talk with a counselor about their needs?
The best way is our website. We've got a really extensive website. And so even if somebody's not interested for whatever reason in coming to one of our intensive workshops, there's so much that they could just read that we hope will be helpful. And that website is BethesdaWorkshops.org. So Bethesda, BethesdA, workshops, plural with an S, .org. So that's the easiest way. Anyone's also welcome to call us. We have a toll-free number. It's 866-464-HEAL. And that translates to 866-464-4325.
And she is referencing HEAL, H-E-A-L, as in heal yourself.
That's correct.
Well,
yes.
And, you know, clearly, as I'm sitting here thinking about all the people, they can't really afford treatment. They don't. They're having trouble with their bills. But I've been able to see so many professionals that said, we will chop an $80,000 hospitalization into 30 or 20. I've even seen it get reduced to 7, which, and again, is a steal. And yet, to hear that somebody for probably $750 right off the bat, that's all they really need to come up with to get an interest-free payment to go to this workshop and pay it off in 2 or 4 months, that's doable. I mean, we all have family members that can help out if really need be. So I'm just thrilled that this is available. Now, you're a Christian, and this is a Christian ministry of sorts. How does this work for clients that don't particularly see themselves as, quote-unquote, religious?
Sure, that's a great question. We are a Christian-based program, and we're overt about that. At the same time, we are a very grace-based program. I mentioned that I was a preacher's daughter and had many, many challenges with my faith and with the church at large because of sexual abuse, because of betrayal, because of all kinds of things. And so we kind of specialize, if you will, with people who are not real fond of church, who have had different kinds of spiritual woundings. So we're a very grace-based program. We are not going to tell anybody, well, read your Bible more or pray more or, you know, do any of those kinds of religious practices as a solution to this very complex problem. So anyone is welcome. Again, we want them to know what they're walking into so that they are not caught off guard. And yet, anyone is welcome. We've had people of Jewish faith come. We've had Orthodox Jewish individuals come. And obviously some of the, if there's a reference to Jesus or Christ, that doesn't work within their faith system. And so we always tell them, take what you like and leave the rest. But we use stories from Judeo-Christian scriptures, like I just described about the Pool of Bethesda, as illustrations for recovery.
And so, you know, that is a part of the program. And yet at the same time, we make no distinction between Protestant faith and Catholic faith, for example. All are Christians. We are not going to try to, quote, convert someone of any kind of faith, or whether it's another entire belief system like Muslim or Buddhism or something, or someone within a Judeo-Christian Catholic environment. That's not our focus. We don't get distracted by any of those kinds of conversations. Our focus is to help people recover from sexual addiction or being in relationship with someone who's an addict, and to do that within a very relationship-based spirituality where we identify the God of your understanding, which is a 12-step phrase, as a Judeo-Christian God.
Mm-hmm.
But no one else has to accept that. And so as long as someone doesn't get so totally freaked out that they can't hear all the rest of the good things, if they hear some of those stories, they'll be fine at Bethesda workshops. And very often people, in fact, will say, this has been so healing to find people who are real and who are addressing very real problems and not doing it in some Band-Aid kind of, you know, mumbo-jumbo religious words kind of ways, and offering us real help, but within a framework that is part of our heritage, or at least makes sense in terms of the application of some of the teachings.
So let's break this down one more time. In terms of treatment, it's a 4-day program, and you start with the workshops, or you do some pre-work prior to the workshops?
You really can start with the workshop.
Okay.
Obviously, if someone is already in counseling, that's probably a benefit. If they're already involved in a 12-step program, that's a great step for that person to be taking. So generally speaking, our normal participant is either very, very early in the process. Some of them aren't sure they want to get well. We have many people who are acting out on their way to the workshop, kind of their last hurrah, thinking, you know, don't know if this is for me.
Mm-hmm.
Up to people who have been what they define as sober for a year or two, but just recognizing I really want to do some just more concentrated, intense kind of work. And it works for both people. So someone can be just self-referred. They've heard about it because of the Carol the Coach's radio show or from some other reason. Or sometimes they're referred in by a clinician who's had other clients come to the program, or maybe some religious person, a pastor or priest, to someone who has had parishioners come, and they're not in counseling. So either way, they're welcome. We do, some general screening to be certain that it's a good fit for someone, but they're welcome. And then we kind of look at ourselves, Carol, as the ER,
mm-hmm.
meaning you come, you don't stay real long, you get a whole lot of attention and help and understanding, and it's very important and your responsibility to go back home and, in the medical analogy, you know, go see your regular doctor for follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Go be a part of the 12-step group. Go meet with a counselor and work on some of the deeper issues that are the driving engine behind this for most people.
Well, and what I heard you saying before is you also have that whole host of people that you've worked with at Bethesda workshops in terms of other people, and you can have their phone numbers, and you can stay connected to them. And because of that intimacy that's developed, that healthy intimacy, you've got a whole other support group in addition to the 12 steps or your certified sexual addiction counselor.
That's exactly right. We have groups who have been having a reunion of their small group from their workshop, you know, every year for several years, just because they've really connected. We've got groups that are the individuals have figured out a time and they're doing a Skype meeting once a week with each other, or, you know, different kinds of ways to stay connected, because it's a very powerful and bonding experience.
Now, the last thing that you had referenced was that couples then, or partners, can also have some resources available to them through Bethesda. So say one more time what they can do.
It's the same thing that an individual who is a partner of someone who struggles with sex or relationship addiction, we have the same kind of workshop for, again, largely it's her, so I'll use that pronoun, though we have two men coming next week to a workshop, so there are some men who come. And it is a very similar kind of program. Our Healing for Partners, we call it, is best for a person who is a little past that real acute horror and trauma of discovery or disclosure of their loved one's addiction. You know, they
so traumatic.
Quote, get past that, but you know, they didn't find out last week, and now they're coming this week. They have some time to grieve that, to just kind of get their feet under them just a little bit to be able to focus and to hear some additional information and things. So it's usually somewhere at least a month or so out from that acuteness of that issue. But they're able to come and, again, work with people who understand and get help for themselves. Our Healing for Partners workshop is not about how do you understand and help your addict.
It's right. About how do you help yourself.
Yourself. That's exactly right. So
that's such a hard concept. And, I know that with the partners that I work with, they know it's about themselves, but they get so easily waylaid into worrying again about the partner. So for a partner that may feel stuck, maybe they're in therapy and they're in good therapy, but they need more intensive time to focus on themselves, again, this is a great jump start for them and an adjunct for the therapy they're already with. So I want to remind our listeners that they can go to www.bethesdaworkshops.org, or they can call 1-866-464-4325, or they can always email me and I will get you this information, because I can tell you I've interviewed people all over the country, and truly, Marnie, this sounds like one of the most reasonable, affordable programs available to any of the addicts or their partners. So I just commend you for the work.
Thank you.
Yeah, and the work that your staff does. And for people that are wondering about this, I mean, really, get No Stones, Women Redeemed from Sexual Shame. It's on Amazon. And it's also on the Bethesda website, right?
Right, yes. Yes.
And that new book that you were talking about, again, you said that is Making Advances, and that's for the clinicians. So you can recommend to your therapist, you got to get this new book about love and sex addiction for women, and it's Making Advances. And what's the whole title of that book?
Then the subtitle is A Comprehensive Guide for Treating Female Sex and Love Addicts. Carol, I want to brag on our staff just a little bit. Even at this affordable price, all of our staff are at least master's level licensed clinicians. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, a step that we think is really important to not have just bachelor's level people or even just great people in recovery themselves. We have licensed clinicians, and 63% of our clinical staff are CSATs, that you mentioned, certified sex addiction therapists. So we really have top-notch staff, and the vast majority of our staff are personally in some form of recovery, addictive or co-addictive recovery. So they get it from that standpoint as well.
Well, Marnie, thank you so much for spending your time tonight going over the program as well as talking about love and sex addiction. And I just can't say enough about this program and your book, and you just keep up the wonderful work you're doing.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate this fabulous broad audience with Carol the Coach. So thank you so much for inviting me to participate tonight.
Okay, and I'll look forward to seeing you at the next conference. Marnie and I were both CSATs together, weren't we?
Yes, we were. We sure were. So thanks. Thanks, Carol.
You're welcome, Marnie. You take care, and I've got to tell you, I'm going to be sending people your way.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, so we have to end the show for right now, but I think you can hear her passion as she speaks about the difference in love and sex addiction and, you know, her mission to be available to women all over the country and their partners. And as I end every show, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself, and I'll see you back here next week at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time with Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Have a great week.